Hello, I'm Emily, and I'm a library associate at the St. Paul Public Library. One of the definitive books about St. Paul's physical environment was written about 15 years ago, St. Paul's Architecture, A History, by Jeffrey Hess and Paul Larson, offers a different approach to looking at St. Paul's historic buildings. Both chronologically and stylistically driven, the book had originally been designed to focus on St. Paul's architecture up to 1985. But additional time allowed the authors to gain new insights into later structures, and the book now concludes with buildings from the year 2000. It includes street addresses wherever possible, so readers can visit the sites for themselves. I am reading the introduction from the book that gives an overview of the material it includes. St. Paul's Architecture, A History, is available at the St. Paul Public Library and can be ordered by visiting sppl.org. St. Paul's Architecture, A History, by Jeffrey A. Hess and Paul Clifford Larson. Introduction. St. Paul has long been known for its magnificent residential drive known as Summit Avenue, but the city's architectural heritage is much more than this single road through the past. Preservation districts now embrace the warehouses of Lower Town, the houses nestled around Irvine Park in Upper Town, the largely working-class neighborhoods of Dayton's Bluff on the east side, and the extreme west end of the city's old transportation corridor on University Avenue. For all these marks of recognition and preservation of its architectural heritage, there has been no connected effort to view St. Paul's landmarked areas and buildings as part of continuous development. This book takes up that challenge. We have chosen a somewhat unusual framework for an architectural history. The general progression is chronological, but the story unfolds in a succession of five quite different chapters. Each chapter offers its own approach, chosen for its power to shed light on a particular era's architectural legacy. Successive chapters present their stock of buildings within a framework that is illuminating for that period. The focus of the book throughout is on buildings that have survived. Lost buildings receive notice only if they were an anchoring presence in the cityscape or represent a type with no living examples. Addresses and other locational clues are provided for each building mentioned in the text in the belief that direct observation can reveal values and stir associations that a narrative can only hint at. By appreciating more deeply the buildings still with us, we build hope for a future that will have fewer occasions to mourn its architectural losses. The opening chapter tells the story of St. Paul's architectural beginnings, from the establishment of the first permanent enclave at the Lower Landing in 1840 to the onset of the nationwide depression in the mid-1870s. Seeking a unifying theme or general trend would falsify the scattered character of the city's early development. This chapter, therefore, focuses largely on individual structures and their owners, beginning with the log chapel that gave the city its name and climaxing with the rugged stone Alexander Ramsay House. The buildings in this chapter have been selected for the degree to which they illuminate the founding of the city, then linked through their aesthetic character, method of construction, siting, and associated personalities. St. Paul at this early stage is largely a vanished city, forcing the exposition to wander now and again from the book's focus on extant buildings. Yet the legacy of mid-19th century St. Paul still shapes the city's sense of place and identity. During its first two decades, St. Paul established itself as a state capital and cathedral city, a transportation and warehousing hub, and a Flats and Bluffs river town. It also acquired the picturesque New England look that still inspires comment from Eastern visitors. The city's first public monuments, concentrated neighborhoods, and commercial rows may have disappeared, but its small public squares, particularly Irvine, Rice, and Smith, now Mears, parks, each retain considerable vitality, and the city's proliferation of narrow streets, skewed grids, and terminal vistas continue to madden as they charm. The second chapter immerses the reader in the city's period of most rapid growth, when it attained its present boundaries and emerged as a regional metropolitan center. The building boom of the 1880s attracted and nurtured the city's first flock of professional architects, many of whom helped usher the city into the 20th century. Cass Gilbert, the renowned architect of the state capitol, was among these. So was Clarence Johnston, the official state architect for 30 years. Because the collective work of this growing professional community defines so much of the city's emerging character, this second part of the story gravitates around the architects themselves as a creative and energizing force in the city. Unlike the master carpenters who had previously held sway, this new class of professionals tended toward a visionary view of their work, either as artistic creation of a high order, or as a business upon which the city's and America's future would depend. They looked constantly to the east, sometimes no farther than Chicago, for inspiration and direction. Over the next 40 years, spanning a second generation of the profession, St. Paul accumulated much of its most characteristic and enduring building stock. The third chapter focuses on architectural fashions between the world wars. During that period, an obsession with style and mood in the arts, both fine and practical, swept the nation. Like Hollywood movie sets, architectural styles looked to other countries and times for inspiration, dressing up the past and the foreign in equally exotic clothing. The Edward Brooks House on Mississippi River Boulevard, now the residence of the president of the University of Minnesota, captures the formalizing aspect of this period. At the other extreme are the sprawling quasi-medieval cottages that dot the streets just east of the river. Architectural fashion gave free rein to a dozen styles or substyles simultaneously. Rather than supplanting each other, they lived in uneasy harmony, each boasting its own advantages, but none innocent of stealing from the others. By the end of World War II, the lion's share of the land within the city limits had been developed. For the next 40 years, from 1945 to 1985, the focus of both cities' officials and the architectural community was largely on rebuilding. As projects dramatically increased in cost and complexity, their design and construction became team efforts involving both private and public players within a conceptual framework generally known as city planning. Its climatic moment was the Capitol Center project of the 1970s, from which the downtown is still progressing or recovering, depending on one's point of view. This institutional context, combining the modernist zeal of the post-war architectural profession with the widespread public perception of a city in need of radical repair, informs the fourth chapter. These four chapters take the history of the city as far forward as it was intended to go at the inception of the book. But as the timeline of research and assimilation stretched, a new period grew up, now nearly two decades in length. As these buildings are now still relatively fresh in creation and use, they are the hardest to describe and assess within a sound historical context. In addition, they grow out of multiple and often conflicted impulses. Modernism and preservation consciousness no longer have the purity that marked their early clashes and accommodations of the 1970s. Both are equally informed by respect for the living past and the urgency of present developmental needs and opportunities. The final chapter makes no attempt to extend the panoramic efforts of the earlier chapters, nor does it make any judgments about selection or omission as to the best or most characteristic architecture of the past two decades. Considered purely on their architectural merits, the corporate headquarters of St. Paul Insurance Companies, now the St. Paul Travelers Insurance Company, and the Science Museum of Minnesota, assuredly have their critics as well as their devotees. Our purpose is simply to lay bare the multiplicity of context, geographical and historical, within which architectural creation continues to happen in St. Paul, with examples of particularly clear contextual responses. This book was many years of research and writing, but the end result is faithful to the original thematic conception developed by Jeffrey Hess and approved by the Heritage Preservation Commission. Although the authors share responsibility for all of the text, each of the chapters fell most heavily on the shoulders of one or the other. Chapters 1 and 4 are largely Hess's work and reflect his voice, whereas the 2nd, 3rd, and 5th are, for the most part, the creation of Paul Larson. Hess, however, contributed most of the information about the city's engineering office and its work to the second chapter, and Larson's research and writing helped to drive the fourth chapter to its completion. Every historian, indeed every friend of old buildings, is bound to have a different slate of favorites. Well before the closing chapter, many readers familiar with the city will find some of their personal favorites omitted. In reference to individual buildings, we can only say that what makes this book worth reading is the fact that St. Paul's architectural heritage is rich enough to exceed the compass of any single-volume study. The best that can be hoped for is a selection that does justice to the chronological, stylistic, and typological scope of that heritage. There is a larger issue here, however, one deserving of a less cryptic response. The chapter themes have been chosen in part for how wide a canopy they spread over the buildings of their respective periods. The most significant buildings of the late 19th century, for example, were all architect design, just as the leading architecture of the period between the wars conscientiously pursued one of the period's many popular stylistic options. This leaves out of consideration a good deal of the city's historic building stock. St. Paul's streets are lined with ordinary houses and business blocks that grew up without an architect and lack of any clear earmarks of style. We have left these simple structures for another sort of history, not because they are unimportant, but because their architectural values, even at the level of floor planning and material choices, are largely derivative from the kinds of buildings that leave a more conspicuous architectural legacy. Occasionally, ordinary buildings are shoved under a different sort of umbrella altogether, identified by the tag vernacular. But vernacular architecture, properly speaking, grows up within long-standing local or regional traditions and makes distinctive use of local materials. For a time, it looked as if the rugged limestone houses and business blocks of the 1850s and 1860s would initiate such a tradition. But St. Paul simply had too short a history as a roughly hewn river town for the vernacular impulse to survive more than a generation. By the time of the city's great building boom of the mid-1880s, it had already succumbed to the influence of Eastern and European-trained architects and the domination of national architectural currents. The lion's share of standing local buildings that tempt the application of the term vernacular are in fact little more than either toned-down versions of styles and plans originally developed by architects or utilitarian structures responsive to the needs and requirements that lack the impetus of a distinctive regional culture. Historic fabric weaves through every area of the city, and we have tried to honor its ubiquity with a broad geographical sampling. If a disproportionate number of references are to buildings in the downtown area or along the broad western axis formed by Summit Avenue and West 7th Street, that is only because these areas happen to be especially clear and well-preserved carriers of pervasive architectural themes. Continued preservation activity in old residential areas, such as the East and West Sides, or along commercial strips, such as University and Payne Avenues, could raise many exemplars on a par with those illustrated here. It's our hope that this study will not be taken as an exhaustive guide, but as a tool for viewing and valuing all of St. Paul's splendid architectural legacy.